The National Broadcasting Company presents Lives of Great Men, a new series on great leaders in human progress, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author of The Soul of Democracy and many other books. In his talks, Dr. Griggs is building a story of civilization based on outstanding characters through the ages and how each one influences his own and future times. This evening, Dr. Griggs will discuss W.B. Yeats and the poetry of Ireland. We present Edward Howard Griggs.
My friends, Ireland, land of immemorial sorrows, of wild gaiety and somber melancholy, of exuberant humor and strange superstitions, of heroic enthusiasms and sorrowing submission, of utterly loyal women and wide-wandering men, is unique among all peoples of the earth. Possessed of a druidic tradition and an ancient culture equal in fascination to that of Arthur and the Round Table, early Christianized, repeatedly torn by invasion, conquered and long dominated by a more materialistic race, Ireland has ever been warmed by a fire of devotion flaming in every Irish heart. English-speaking peoples may quarrel among themselves, but instinctively they present a united front to the world. Across the centuries, Irish troops helped fight England's battles, and the dominant people finally became generous. With the establishment after the World War of the Irish Free State, much of the old independence was regained. Meantime, late in the 19th century, the Irish awoke to fresh consciousness of their cultural inheritance with an eager desire to recover it and achieve a new culture worthy of the great tradition. The outstanding leader in that awakening was William Butler Yeats. Reared a Protestant, but temperamentally sympathetic with all in the Catholic tradition, passionately loving the ancient culture with its weird fairy lore, establishing the Irish theater and writing numerous plays for it, associating other artists with the movement, especially Lady Gregory and Synge, struggling to free the cultural awakening from all partisan political bias, he led in achieving for Ireland a new national culture, not equaled in any other nation of our time. Always the Irish have loved and produced poetry and song, but their poets had been handicapped either by writing in hatred of England, or like Tom Moore, having to write primarily for an English audience. The idea of Yeats was that the new art should be free from both limitations, without political intent, and created for the Irish people. Yeats was born near Dublin in 1865. His paternal grandfather, for whom he was named, was a clergyman of County Down. His maternal grandfather, the dominating William Pollexfen, a seafaring shipowner of Sligo. The extensive autobiography published shortly before the recent death of Yeats contains reveries over his young years, portraying a sensitive, dreamy child growing up at his grandfather's home in Sligo and early fascinated by the Irish fairy lore and the nature world of lakes and mountains. His father was a distinguished painter, member of the Royal Hibernian Academy, influenced by the late Pre-Raphaelites, and then turning to French masters. While highly gifted, he was so fastidious as to be ever repainting a work, and so finding difficulty in finishing it. Of his schooling, Yeats says, "Because I found it hard to attend to anything less interesting than my thoughts, I was difficult to teach." He was late in learning to read, with irregular terms in dame schools. At 9, he was sent to London and put to school in Hammersmith, where he felt himself to be a foreigner in a strange land. The family came to live at Bedford Park. There were compensating annual visits to Sligo on his grandfather's ships, and when Yeats was 15, the family moved to Dublin. Another period of desultory schooling followed. But his real education was going forward through his rambles and studies in natural science, and his father's reading great poems to him. For a time, he was in an art school, the father vainly hoping the son might also become a painter. At this period, Yeats came more closely in touch with the belief of the Irish countryside in the other people, the world of mysterious beings imagined to influence human life. In the Irish fairy lore is a sinister element, not present in the English tradition, which has nothing comparable to banshee and leprechaun. The Irish custom of referring to the fairy race as the good people springs from the fear of disaster coming from them. As a child, Yeats believed implicitly in the fairy lore. In the Dublin period, he became deeply interested in theosophy and other Oriental faiths. This led later to a study of older occult mysteries, turning him back on the Druid tradition of his own race. While in no sense a mystic, this ever-deepening interest in the mysterious continued, at least in emotional and poetic form, his childhood faith in the fairy lore. In the autobiography are numerous passages recording instances of fulfillment of dream premonitions, of thought transference, of second sight, giving glimpses of the mysterious beings of the popular imagination. As he grew to manhood, Yeats came to recognize poetry as his life call. He was working to that end when again in London at 22 for 4 years. There he came into close contact with William Morris, Henley, Oscar Wilde, Arthur Symons, and other literary men, which contact was his college education. The first work giving him audience was The Wanderings of Oisin, published at 24, a rendering in exquisite poetry of part of the ancient Irish inheritance. It was the beginning of a service for Irish folklore, comparable in a measure to what Tennyson had done for England in The Idylls of the King. With little ear for musical notation, Yeats had keen appreciation of the beauty of words and labored earnestly to achieve it. He wrote slowly and with the fastidiousness of his father's painting, polishing and repolishing for perfect artistic form. In the first period of poetic work, his lyrics often strike a happy note, and there is much description of the nature world. Meantime, he founded the Irish Literature Societies in London and Dublin and dreamed of establishing an Irish National Theatre. He tells of discovering that in the performance of all drama that depends for its effect upon beauty of language, poetical culture may be more important than professional experience. This indicates the aim in all the best of his own dramatic work, since it was beauty of language for which he constantly strove and which he surpassingly achieved. Early in his 30s, Yeats formed his friendship with Lady Gregory. Each was deeply to influence the other. She gathered up the ancient folklore and beautifully translated it, afterwards writing her charming plays for their theater. She kept Yeats from wasting himself on journalistic work, telling him, "The only wrong act that matters is not doing one's best work." She made her beautiful home his home whenever he wished it. He tells us that until he was 50, he never earned more than $1,000 a year. She insisted on lending him money to keep him free to work at his poetry. He mentions repaying $2,500 through the proceeds of an American lecture tour. Which task seems to pay those from other lands better than poetry? The first play by Yeats to be given on the stage was The Countess Kathleen. It had been bitterly attacked on religious grounds because, Yeats says, the Irish take symbols for realities. Some 20 policemen were present to prevent a riot. The play was nevertheless successful and launched Yeats on his career as stage dramatist. The Countess Kathleen is a weird symbolic story of the Great Famine. The Countess lavishes her wealth to relieve the misery, but it is too vast. Merchants from the power of darkness come to buy the souls of the starving wretches. These evil ones rob the Countess of her possessions, and in desperate resolve to aid the sufferers, she sells her soul and dies. The angel tells her poet lover, Alil, "The light beats down, the gates of pearl are wide, and she is passing to the floor of peace. The light of lights looks always on the motive, not the deed, the shadow of shadows on the deed alone." Next came the tender and lovely Land of Heart's Desire, in which Yeats interprets the Irish fairy lore with his fascinating yet sinister mystery. The young bride, Mairead Bruin, loving her husband but lonely of heart, not yet brought submission to the dull routine of life, is tired of it all. So longing for freedom, to dance with the others on winds, waves, and mountains, she yields to the fairy charm and dies. It is all symbols, but what subtle symbolism of life. The Shadowy Waters, dedicated to Lady Gregory, with a prelude poem on the seven woods of Cool, her home, is in the same key with Heart's Desire. Forgale sails the remote seas, following the bird guides, under the lure of the transcendent that lifts and disturbs the heart of man. The chords of the light irradiating harp, a far more beautiful and effective symbol than Wagner's, works the magic of the love potion in Tristan und Isolde, fusing Forgale and Dectora in the immortal, fatal charm of love and death. As the rope is cut that binds their ship to the safely homeward bound treasure ship, Dectora exclaims, "The world drifts away, and I am left alone with my beloved, who cannot put me from his sight forever. We are alone forever, and I laugh, Forgale, because you cannot put me from you. The mist has covered the heavens, and you and I shall be alone forever. O flower of the branch, O bird among the leaves, O silver fish that my two hands have taken out of the running stream, O morning star, trembling in the blue heavens like a white fawn upon the misty border of the wood, bend lower that I may cover you with my hair, for he will gaze upon this world no longer. And Forgale, beloved, having dragged the net about us and knitted mesh to mesh, we grow immortal, and that old harp awakens of itself to cry aloud to the gray birds, and dreams that have had dreams for fathers live in us. It is all the haunting melody of words, transfused with the emotion of the moment that is eternal, of the lure of the impossible dream that transfigures and breaks life. The same mood, with more of action and human reality, is in the beautiful and tragic Dardery and in the stormy on Bailey's Strand. Kathleen Ni Houlihan, a poetic play of tender beauty, interprets that spirit of Ireland whose challenge to the Irish heart is beyond all appeal of wife and home. Nevertheless, with Yeats, it is the power of the eternal spirit of Ireland, with no hint of political antagonism or racial hate. With the help of friends, the Abbey Theatre was finally established, and Yeats' dream of a truly national Irish theatre realized. Lady Gregory was his right hand, and Sing, till his early death, his left. Sing's playboy was almost as bitterly attacked as the Countess Kathleen had been. The pure poetic drama, with sustained beauty of language, did not prove as successful on the stage as those plays pungently portraying phases of Irish character with the aid of dialect. The later plays of Yeats, written under the influence of Lady Gregory and often in collaboration with her, depart from the pure poetry and symbolism of the earlier examples. Yeats wrote beautiful prose as well as poetry, and with the same artistic finish. The autobiography contains an amazing range of frank and pungent characterizations of those associated with the Irish Awakening, in both its cultural and political aspects, thus giving a full history of the revival. His disgust with the overemphasis of the political and consequent clouding of the cultural phase is everywhere evident. When the Irish Free State was established, Yeats was made one of its first senators, showing the recognition he had won, as also his deep interest in Ireland's freedom. In 1923, much to his surprise, he received the Nobel Prize in Literature, the inscription stating that it was given for his consistently emotional poetry, which in the strictest artistic form expresses a people's spirit. With his wife, Yeats journeyed to Sweden to receive the award. The closing portion of his autobiography, On the Bounty of Sweden, shows how deeply he was impressed both with Sweden's progress in the arts and her skillful handling of the problems of representative government. Apparently, the smaller nations have much to teach the big ones in the solution of problems both cultural and political. In his later lyric poetry, Yeats entered a third period. There is no more the decorative element of his earlier verse, nor does he lean on the great tradition of Ireland's past. The poems deal directly with life, its tangles and experiences, and every word is made to count with precise significance. There is still great beauty, but beauty subordinated to interpretation of life. Overall is a somber mood of autumn, with winter promised. In his plays as in his poems, Yeats is distinctly poet rather than stage dramatist. As creator of pure poetry, he can be ranked first of his age, working steadily to the end, and his death so recent, occurring January 28, 1939, more than the other masters studied, he is of our own time.
W.B. Yeats and the Poetry of Ireland has been the subject of another program in the series titled Lives of Great Men, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author. Next week, Dr. Griggs will speak on G.K. Chesterton, a modern man of letters.